I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
At The Intercooler, we're proud to have JBR Capital on board as a podcast sponsor. They're a great fit for us because, like The Intercooler, they're geared up around the car enthusiast. JBR Capital is the UK's only independent finance lender dedicated solely to high-end vehicle finance. That's all the company does. It means JBR Capital knows the car marketplace inside out and therefore is properly geared up to tailor finance quotes around the individual. There's no one-size-fits-all approach with JBR. In 2022, the company expects to surpass £1 billion of lending in only its eighth year. The company can finance new cars, classic cars, sports cars, supercars, hypercars, any car, in fact, with a value greater than £25,000. The company's motto is fund your passion. And let's face it, without car finance, how many of us would really be able to afford to fund our passion for cars? So get in touch with JBR Capital before buying your next car. You'll find contact information in the description. And as ever, tell them The Intercooler sent you. JBR Capital is authorised and regulated by the Financial Conduct Authority. Welcome to The Intercooler Podcast. Welcome to episode 105 of The Intercooler Podcast. I'm Dan Prosser with Andrew Frankel, with a tired Andrew Frankel, I think.
Slightly.
He's had quite a weekend. He wasn't going to mention this, but I'm going to. Andrew ran the Brighton Marathon yesterday, raised a load of money for charity for a really good cause. And he did it in a strong time as well. So congratulations, Andrew.
Thank you.
That was a heck of an effort. But that wasn't your most memorable run this weekend, was it? Because you also had a run around Goodwood, not on foot, but in a very special car.
Yeah, I mean, it was... You wouldn't choose to do those two things on the same weekend because they're sort of slightly sort of diametrically opposed in terms of... Well, you know, it's not ideal marathon prep to spend a day getting revved up to drive a Group C car, but not that I'm complaining because, well, we'll talk about it later on, but we had, I think there were 18 Group C Porsches out there and we were allowed to go fast. I drove the car at sundown and going around the back of the grid, I'll talk about it later, but, you know, even among Group C Porsches, I drove the most extraordinary car. And to be in that... at that place, at that time of day, in that company. I said at the time, it might be the most magical thing I've done in a car. Even now I've had time to sort of calm down and think about it, I don't think I would necessarily change that view very much. It was extraordinary, but that's for a bit later in the podcast, I think.
We're using this as an opportunity to talk about Group C generally, the endurance racing category, introduced by the FIA in 1982, and it ran until 1993. So a decent length of time. How do you sort of reflect on Group C generally? Is that your favourite era of endurance racing, or do you still hanker after, you know, the early 70s or something?
Yeah, I think, you know, the early 70s... will always be the era. And when we say the early 70s, we actually only really mean 70 and 71, because that was when, you know, the Porsche 917 and the Ferrari 512s were at it. And they were, I think they were the most beautiful cars, and they were driven by the most heroic drivers who faced consequences that even 10 years later were not likely, although it did happen. And I think in terms of sort of gladiatorial conquest and all the sort of things that sort of made us worship the people and adore the cars, I still think those early 70s cars are the things. But if ever there was a sort of honourable runner-up to it, it is Group C. And the reason we're talking about this, obviously, is it's 40 years of Group C this year. And also the other thing was that not even I'm old enough to remember, you know, the cars of the early 1970s doing their thing. I'm absolutely old enough to remember Group C. In fact, the first Le Mans I ever went to was 1988, when Jaguar ended a series of straight six wins for Porsche at Le Mans. And I'll never forget it. So I think for most people listening to this who are of a certain age, sadly, you're not one of them, Group C resonates because it's the first really great era of sports car racing which we were actually around to witness. And it was a great... I mean, if you look at the manufacturers who got involved and some of the cars, and also, you know, sports car formulas, Formula One car formulas, you know, they're so prescribed these days. You know, cars look very similar. Mechanically, they're almost identical. And they're scraping and scratching around for tiny little areas of differences within the rules. Group C... You know, we'll talk about it shortly, I'm sure. You could almost do what you liked. I mean, the outline, the rule book was so open to interpretation, but it was so thin, there just weren't many rules. As long as you basically didn't use more than a certain amount of fuel, and this is a massive generalisation, this isn't specifically true, but, you know, that was the primary consideration. And if you could meet that, up to you how you do it. And it just brought some incredible variety of cars, and noises and sounds and shapes and everything else. And yeah, I just absolutely loved it.
It was a fuel consumption category rather than an engine capacity category. So at Le Mans and in sports car racing beforehand, you might be limited to 5,000 cc's or something. This was a different approach. So you had a certain amount of fuel. The minimum weight of the car was 800 kilograms. The maximum fuel capacity, 100 litres. So they were given 600 litres for a race, and that's 132 gallons, 621 miles was each race, 1,000 kilometres. So the cars would have to do about 5 miles per gallon. I just ran some quick numbers there, just to give some idea of how much fuel the cars had to play with for a 1,000 kilometre race, around 5 miles per gallon. And the FIA hoped that it would prevent manufacturers from simply concentrating just on engine development. There's this theory that especially Porsche and Lancia had become so wrapped up in just developing engines that other things were being left to one side. It became about, before Group C, it became about turbocharger boost pressure, just about raw power at the expense of everything else. So the new rules set this fuel consumption limit, and the teams could more or less do what they wanted to do around that. So it's actually a very open rule book, isn't it? I think when we have those, we see variety in the cars, variety in method, variety in engineering. And I always just think that makes for a much more interesting, richer category.
You see, at the time, we were so naive, certainly I was so naive, mine was a voice of many, who couldn't believe how terrible this idea sounded. So hang on, so these are going to be economy runs. You're just going to have cars going around nowhere near the true potential of what they could do, desperately trying to save fuel. I really think this isn't racing. And it just showed, I think, how blinkered we were. And happily, the engineers saw it a completely different way. They saw this as a whole new landscape of opportunity for them to do really, really smart things. And particularly, you know, the fundamental choices. And, you know, if you look at, let's talk about the engines for a moment. So, well, I mean, in 1982, Lancia, who were being a bit cute with the rules, because they're technically racing under all Group C rules, but nevertheless, within Group C races, they had the LC1, which had a 1.4 litre four-cylinder engine in it and was extremely quick. Okay? At the other end of it, you know, I think Jaguar got up to a 7.4 litre V12. And within that, you had six-cylinder cars, eight-cylinder cars, turbocharged cars, unturbocharged cars. You obviously had the Mazdas with their screaming rotary engines. And, you know, you could do what you liked. And the only problem with that approach is you do make yourself vulnerable to someone having a better idea than anybody else. Which certainly in the early days of Group C is what Porsche did. And, you know, Porsche didn't, well, they did rewrite the rule book, but it wasn't because they came up with some whizzo technology. I mean, the engine that they used in Group C was an old IndyCar engine, which they bunged in the back of the 936 to win Le Mans in 1981. The 936 then being literally the car that won Le Mans in 1981 of the old Group 6 rules had been in the museum, and they wheeled it out and it won the race. And then they took that engine unchanged and stuck it in the 956. And the 956, remember, Porsche had never ever designed a car with a monocoque before. They'd never designed a car with full ground effect aerodynamics before. But they just did their sums right. And what they recognised was that, I mean, the big trade-off was, you know, you could have more power with a turbo engine, but it used more fuel. So do you go normally aspirated, like Jaguar did, and you have an engine which will actually be quite economical, which means that if you have a completely untroubled normal race, then you'll have an advantage. Or do you do what Porsche did and have a turbocharged engine, except you're going to use more fuel, but that doesn't matter in qualifying, so you'll always start at the front. If it rains or there's a safety car, then you can just bank all that fuel and then you can turn the boost. And the thing about the turbo cars is that they just had much more flexibility and they could manage their race strategy because they could choose how much fuel. And yeah, if a race was dry and long and nothing went wrong, the turbo cars were at a disadvantage, and ultimately the Jaguars ended up beating them, although, you know, only after 6 years of complete Porsche domination. But if anything happened, you could just wind the boost right back, wind the mixture right back, save fuel, which you could then, once, you know, the accident had been cleared or the weather cheered up, you could then go so much faster than normally aspirated cars because you'd bank the fuel. So those were the sort of calculations that the engineers were making at the time. And, you know, the other thing was you had to use a block that was derived from a road car. So Porsche couldn't go and make a brand new engine for this thing. You know, they had to use, you know, something which was at a distance related to the same engine you find in the 911. Jaguar had to use the V12 out of their road car. I think Mercedes with their V8, I think that sort of came out of, you know, some big S-Class saloon or something. So, you know, even if Porsche had thought to itself, oh, what we really need is a 6-litre V8, well, they didn't have one. So they had to go with what they got. And, you know, the 956 and the 962 are the result, and they just did it better than anybody else.
I think when we reflect on sort of golden periods in motor racing, often what we're looking at is periods that were very well supported by the great manufacturers. And Group C absolutely was. There was just so much manufacturer interest, which, A, I mean, it keeps some of the great names on the grid. B, it's more relatable, I suppose. And if you happen to own a Jaguar and Jaguar's racing at Le Mans, it just adds a layer of intrigue, doesn't it? A layer of interest. But it also means that they have the resource, they have the financial wherewithal to employ big name drivers. And so you've got the great manufacturers, but also a brilliant roster of racing drivers competing, which again is another thing that adds interest. You might have supported one of these drivers for, I don't know, 10 years in Formula One or something, and then here he is racing at Le Mans. And I mean, some great, great names competed in Group C over the years. And the manufacturers, you've mentioned a few, Porsche, Jaguar, Mercedes, Nissan, Toyota, Mazda, Aston Martin, loads of them. Peugeot, and it's, yeah, I mean, there were just so many reasons why this was an arresting and captivating formula. And I sort of, I don't remember any of it, but I look back on it enviously now. I'm sure you all had a whale of a time watching this.
On the drivers, I mean, the other thing which always fascinated me about the drivers is the drivers they attracted came at both ends of their careers. So, you know, obviously you have the legends, you have the Derek Bells and the Jackie Ickses, both of whom came to sports car racing after their single seat careers. But also, you know, you had guys like, you know, Michael Schumacher, Ayrton Senna did at least one Group C race, you know, guys who were just sort of finding their way and wanted to get noticed. And actually, because the races back then were so well supported and publicised, and because it was another string to your bow, and you'd hope because it just sounded like fun, all sorts of, young guns who went to win on, multiple Formula One championships, cut their teeth to an extent in Group C.
So why did Group C ultimately come to an end? I mean, these things always do eventually, don't they? Nothing lasts forever. What did it for Group C?
It fell victim to it a bit. Well, it'd obviously been around for a very long time, and it had attracted a lot of Formula One drivers. And the rulemakers decided that they wanted to kind of harmonise and make sports car racing a bit more like Formula One. So what they decided to do is they came up with a new category of cars, which were based with around Formula One cars, Formula One engines, 3.5 litre V12 engines, and that immediately made it massively more expensive. I mean, one other thing about Formula One, particularly back then, 30 years ago, they weren't terribly reliable units. You could probably get them to function reasonably well for a couple of hours in a Formula One race, but for 24 hours, that was a whole different level of engineering and investment and understanding and know-how to get that right. But they went and did it, and it just killed Group C stone dead. To the extent that they had to go, hang on, we'll come up with some regulations which allows you to run Group C cars, old Group C cars. But they gave them like a sort of 1,000 kilogram weight limit, so they were never going to be competitive. And They just ruined it. And by 1994, it was dead. So these regs came in, I think, in 91. And you had stupid situations like, in 1991, when these regulations came up, Mercedes and Jaguar turned up at Le Mans with their 3.5 litre F1-based engines with no intention of racing. Andy Wallace went and recorded the fastest lap of Le Mans that year, and he did it in, it's either practice or qualifying, in an XJR14, which no one had any intention of racing, and so it just became a sort of pantomime. And the cars that were out there didn't last. So the Peugeots, they retired; they're very unreliable, and then off you go. And it was, it was silly. I mean, that race was actually won by the Mazda, which was technically running under Group C regulations, but because it was a rotary engine, it didn't have to subscribe to this 1,000 kilogram limit. It could run at, I think it was 830 kilograms, and so they had a massive advantage over the Jaguars, which came second, third, and fourth. And this new brilliant bright era of sports car racing basically never materialized. In 92 and 93, the only manufacturers in the new category were Peugeot and Toyota. Peugeot were utterly dominant. Won both races, nobody cared, and that was the end of it. Packed it up. I mean, it was a victim of its own success to an extent, but, they made a rule change which simply wasn't required, and that was that. Shame, really.
Yeah, so, but what was another quirk of the demise of Group C, that Group C cars, or modified, adapted Group C cars, continued to win Le Mans, like the Dower 962?
Yeah, I mean, the Dower was a very strange case. I mean, that one in 1994, and again, this was just, we see this so many times, it's just someone not thinking out the rule, but very quickly. And so what they wanted in 1994 was a category where GT cars could race on an even footing with prototypes. So they had to completely hobble the prototypes. to make the GT cars anything like it. And so it was actually Porsche did the Dauer. It was always, it was meant, technically it's a private entry, and you know, in public Porsche will go, well, we don't know much about that. They knew everything about it. They were absolutely, they were up to their neck in the Dauer. And they turned a 962 into a GT car. They just crit, well, so, well, you know, and they looked through the regs and said, nothing we can, there's nothing to stop us just entering a 962, adapting it and entering it as a GT car. At that stage, you have a prototype racing car, you know, racing alongside road cars, and, you know, it's not very surprising what happens. So, yeah, that was just Porsche being smart with the rules.
And then even after that, and you've written about the Porsche WSC 95 before,
yeah.
Which is a curious case, isn't it? It's because actually it was part Porsche, part Jaguar, and all sorts of other things. It's
And all TW. I mean, it was. It might even been the actual car. You know, I mentioned earlier that Andy Wallace had gone and done that amazing lap in the XJR 14 in 91. Well, the WSC 95, which won Le Mans in 96 and 97, was that car, despite the fact that by now it was open rather than closed, and it had a Porsche flat six in the back instead of a Ford V8. But yeah, absolutely bizarre.
Bizarre. So we've mentioned a few Jaguar XJRs, and they are, I mean, they're as much a part of Group C as anything else, really. The 6, the 8, the 9, the 11, the 12, the 14. The 14, just purely aesthetically, I think is my favourite of the Jaguars. Maybe my favourite Group C car, actually. It looks stunning. It looks far more modern, obviously, than the early sort of boxier Group C cars.
Do you know who designed it?
Let's have it.
Little known chap called Ross Brawn.
Ah, interesting.
Yeah.
It had that sort of teardrop shape cockpit. And
beautiful.
Then that wing that hung right out the back of the car.
Yep.
Stunning looking thing. Was it good?
The XJR14?
Yeah.
Oh, well, it was unbelievably successful. I mean, when it first came out, it was almost embarrassingly fast. Martin Brundle, I think he'd probably still say it, said it was the best racing car he ever drove. It was so fast. It was so much better than anything else that was around at the time. But there's no way it would have lasted 24 hours than jumped over the moon. It just wasn't going to happen. It wasn't designed for that sort of thing. So that's why it never raced at Le Mans. But as you're absolutely right, an amazing looking thing.
Let's talk about some of the others. There was a Lamborghini Countach. Actually, it was a space frame racing car, but it had a Countach engine in it. Tiff raced it. Tiff Nidell. It's very short lived. It didn't achieve anything. But I was just surprised in my research to see that there was a car badged Lamborghini Countach QVX. Amazing looking thing. Also the Mazdas, again, a whole run of Mazdas as well.
Yeah.
The one that won in 91, as you've already mentioned, Johnny Herbert among the drivers, was the 787B rotary engine. And it's, I don't think I've ever heard one. Maybe I've heard one at Goodwood or something. But even just watching clips on YouTube, you get a sense of the sound of that thing.
Yeah, they hurt. When they came past in a race, they literally hurt. You had to put your fingers in your ears. It wasn't because, oh, that's a bit loud. There was physical pain, they were so loud. I just kind of hope that with the engine behind you in the cockpit, it wasn't that insane in there because, you just wouldn't have had any hearing left. I mean, they screamed, like no other racing car I've ever heard.
Amazing. Peugeot won Le Mans during that era, 92 and 93.
Yeah, with a 3.5
litre car.
Yeah.
3.5 litre V10, yeah. Mark Blundell, Derek Warwick, Yannick Dalmar in that first year, 92. Jaguar won twice in that era. Sauber Mercedes won once in 1989. I'm not really sure Peugeot gets the recognition it deserves for winning Le Mans twice in that era. And the 905s, there were a couple of different versions of it. Looks
There was
brilliant.
Just no opposition, though. I mean, there were the Toyotas, but they broke. So I don't want to, sort of denigrate it at all because, you know, anybody who wins Le Mans has done an extremely good job. And, you know, and sometimes you win it against really tough opposition and it's extraordinary. And sometimes you don't, but, you know, wins are wins a win. So fair play to them. But because those wins came after the rule change, when frankly, everybody had lost interest and didn't care anymore, you're right, you know, they haven't had the kind of recognition that, just something somebody else who well, I mean, Jaguar won, only won Le Mans twice in that era. They won it in 88 and 90. And then, you know, they're dining out on that to this day.
Just a bit.
Yeah. And the difference is, when Jaguar won it, particularly in 88, but also in 90 to an extent, you know, it was in the teeth of very, very fierce opposition. And these were wins absolutely, you know, hard won. And they just count for more. They just count for more.
So my understanding is that the Porsches, the 956s and the 962s, they were designed and built to be driven by privateers as well. They were sold to customers. And so that meant semi-professional or amateur, even drivers, would drive them.
Yeah.
And so that had to be factored in. Good ventilation, less physical to drive. Whereas others, particularly the Jaguars, they were just works cars, weren't they, with professional drivers in them.
Yeah.
And so they were quite different machines.
Yeah, and they were, I mean, well, I've been lucky enough to drive both kinds. And Jaguars just feel much more fragile, frankly, particularly in the gearboxes. And you've got this big, heavy weight behind you. I mean, they're not friendly cars to drive. You know, you can spin them breaking into a corner, and you can spin them powering out again, because, you know, you've just got this massive 7 litre lump behind you. Think about the Porsche. I can remember Richard Lloyd, my old mate, sadly died in an aircraft accident years and years ago with the equally wonderful David Leslie. But he did really, really well racing 956s and 962s with guys like Jonathan Palmer and James Weaver and so on. But anyway, I mean, he was a, you know, you go to Weissach to collect your new Group C Porsche, and you kind of think that there would be a reception committee and a little fanfare and, you know, introductions and all that. And so they'd literally take you out the back, and they're, and, you know, outside in whatever the weather was, under a tarp, there'd be a car, and they'd go, well, off you go. And so you put this thing on a tailor, and you go down to some track in Europe where you're going to shake it down. But you wouldn't really need to, because you'd fire it up, you'd go out, and the car would be completely competitive. They put a baseline setup on it, which was always, you know, pretty much there or thereabouts. The car would never go wrong. It was brilliantly built. And so you go and race it. And, you know, that's just the way that Porsche did things. They were completely sort of insouciant about it. And what you're saying about making it easy for the driver, you know, to start an XJR9, you've got to flick that, you've got a load of switches and blah, blah, blah. To turn the, start a 962, you just go, blah, you turn a key. You don't even turn a key and press a button. It's actually easier to start a 962 than most modern road cars. You just turn the key. And they have synchromesh gearboxes, because Porsche always recognised the least reliable component of any car was the one with the steering wheel in his hands. And particularly if you're, as you were saying, selling them to privateer drivers, you know, you've got to think, you've got to create a car which will work as well for a privateer driver at 3 a.m. after he's been in the car for hours after hours, and it's chucking it down with the rain, and he's clinically exhausted, than for, you know, Jackie Hicks on lap one. And so they had synchromesh gearboxes, so you didn't get very many gearbox breakages. You know, they had proper ventilation. They were quite easy to get in and out of. You know, the visibility is not great, but it's better than others. And they just thought about this stuff. And obviously, the moment you have a customer program and everybody wants your cars, then, you know, that brings in, you know, an awful lot of revenue, which allows you to develop the cars further. And it becomes a sort of circle of virtue. And, you know, they did extraordinary between 1982 and 1987. I mean, the Lanciers did provide some brief opposition, but not really. The 956s and then the 962s just took everybody else to the cleaners.
So how much 956 is there in a 962? Are they fundamentally different in any way?
No, well, you were, I mean, there are engineers at Porsche who will tell you they are the same car. And, you know, the fundamental difference between a 956 and a 962 is simply the wheelbase. So, actually, the 962 came about, it got nothing to do with Le Mans or the World Sports Car Championship at all. They wanted to race the 956 in America, and IMSA said, no, you can't do that, because our regs say you can't have the driver's feet in front of the front axle line.
That's a good regulation, by the way.
It's probably quite a good regulation, isn't it? And so Porsche thought, well, okay, we'll just extend the wheelbase. And that is why, if you look, that's why a 956 is a prettier car than a 962. It's just better proportion because it has, the 962's got quite a cut-off nose because the wheels are so close to it, whereas a 956 is a longer, more flowing nose. But basically, you know, they are the same car. And of course, you know, the other thing that Porsche did was that they constantly evolved the cars. But they'd have done that whether it was a 956 or a 962. So really, the only difference between a 956 and a 962 is, I can't remember what the actual extension is, but is that the 962 has a longer wheelbase. And they did that not to race the car at Le Mans, but to race it in the States. And then obviously once they'd done that, they could also, there was no point continuing with the 956, so they just raced the 962 on both sides of the Atlantic.
So this was the era, and those are the cars that really solidified Porsche's reputation as the kings of endurance racing.
Yeah.
So they won 6 times in that era.
Yeah.
And I mean, because there was a big customer program, inevitably lots of them were built, relatively speaking. I'm going to put you on the spot here. You might not know the answer, but maybe you can guess. Do you know how many they built between them? 956 and 962?
Well, Porsche didn't even build all of them. When Porsche stopped building them, there are other people who would just go and create chassis. Well, I know the chassis numbers go up into the hundreds, but I don't believe there were 100 or more cars built. But it was probably 70 or 80. I don't know. I have no idea.
That is a lot, though, isn't it? It really is.
Oh, God, I thought you knew the answer.
No, I didn't know the answer. I was hoping you would.
Well, someone will. Okay, someone will let us know. But there were dozens and dozens of them. And also, Dina, don't forget that they didn't just do... You know, Le Mans, they did the World Sports Car Championship and they raced at IMSA. They raced out in Japan a lot. There are a lot of, you know, these cars. You know, the thing, now I'm thinking about it, maybe it was 100. I don't know. But they mean it was the most successful privateer or customer program, clearly, in the history of sports car racing and probably any other series as well.
Goodwood, then.
Oh, yes.
Do you want to set it up a little bit? What were you driving? What was the occasion?
Okay, so the occasion was... Goodwood members meeting, and they usually have a celebration of one particular kind of car or another. And this particular year was celebrations of the 40th anniversary of Group C, and particularly Group C Porsche, because they came in and as I said, dominated from the start. And so what they thought they would do was get a grid together of as many Group C Porsches as they could, and it was absolutely extraordinary. Henry Pearman, our friend Henry Pearman, brought he might have actually brought 9 of his, of which I think only 7 ran. Porsche brought 3, and you know, various other people brought various other cars, and I think we had 18 cars on the grid in the end. And I was talking to Henry about this, and I put it to him that this, and nobody knows more about these cars than Henry Pearman, with the possible exception of the guys at the factory, but maybe not even them. And I said to Henry, would it be fair to say that this, in terms of quality and quantity, was the greatest gathering of Group C Porsches ever seen anywhere in the world at any time, including when they were racing? And he said that he thought it probably was.
Crikey.
Because... For a start, they had 4 Le Mans winners there. Okay, one of them. So they had 3 cars. So they had the 82 Le Mans winner there. And then they had the car that won Le Mans in 84 and 85. And then they had the 87 winner. So they had the first and last Porsche Group C Le Mans winners. And the one that won 2 in between. And some other cars. There were so many. I mean... I was talking to Dickie Meaden about this, and he was genuinely, because he was driving one of the Henry cars, and he was sort of saying, you know, it's entirely possible I'm going to get into the wrong Rothmans Porsche, because there were just so many of them there. Sometimes when I was sort of going down the line, thinking, oh, hang on, which one is mine? Okay, no, so this one's got sprint body on it, so that's not it. This one's got single headlights, so that's not it. Oh, yeah, there's my car. It was absolutely ridiculous. I've never seen any spectacle like it among those cars or anything close. So the car I was driving was the 87 Le Mans winner, owned by the factory. And all it did in its life was, so it was built at the end of 86, And it did a couple of minor races. It had a puncture in one, didn't come very high, and I think it had a gearbox problem, retired from the other. So no history before that. And then the following year, it was the spare car. So in 87, it was the spare car. And so there was no plan to use it. And then something happened. I think what happened was Hans Stuck crashed a car in Weissach, shaking it down or whatever. And it wasn't his car. He was shaking down one of the other race cars. And so whosever car it was meant to be, which wasn't going to race, they said, well, we're going to have your car, Hans. And so, you know, Hans Stuck, Derek Bell and Al Holbert temporarily didn't have a car to race. So they thought, well, you know, we better wheel out the old spare. So they wheeled out the spare and they went out and they won the race. And then apart from, it was the T car in 1988, so it got painted in Shell Dunlop colours, but it was never raced again. So really, you know, it did two little races before it did Le Mans, then did Le Mans, won it, and then never raced again. And it's always been retained by the factory. And the wonderful thing about that, and it's the same with the 82 winner, which did even less. The 82 winner, which was there, literally did Le Mans. And then apart from one demo that Derek did almost immediately afterwards, never moved again until this weekend. Yeah? So, in fact, it was the car. If you've been to the Porsche Museum, everybody talks about this. You go in the Porsche Museum and there's a 956 upside down on the ceiling. That's the 82 winner. And so for the members' meeting, they got it off the ceiling where it had been for decades, or for as long as that Porsche Museum's been open, and got it going again, and put it out in this amazing demonstration. And so these cars they're the best because they've never been crashed. They haven't been pulled together and put back together again a million times. And with all racing cars, particularly of quite long careers, that's what happens. They get crashed, they get different things, and you can't really think to yourself, was that bit on this car when it went over the line at Le Mans? With those two Porsches, everything that's on those cars was on those cars when they won that race. And to me, that's the extraordinary thing. You sit here and you think, this isn't, you know, sort of, you know, quite like or approximate to what Derek and Hans experienced. This is the car. They sat in this seat. They held that steering wheel. They watched those dials. You know, that was the engine. It's just extraordinary. So they did this parade, and the best thing about it was they decided to do it late because they wanted these cars driving into the sunset. I have a bit of a thing about driving to the sunset of Goodwood anyway. I mean, to me, because it's such a beautiful circuit and because it reminds me of the old 9-hour races they used to have there, there's a romantic thing going for me. And I've been quite lucky because we'd been there for a couple of days doing photography and video and that sort of thing. So I've been sort of trundling up and down in this thing, but not fast. But I got a feel for it. So it wasn't a completely alien experience to me. And then, yeah, and then we headed off in this parade. And we had to be behind a course car, but the course car was a new GT3 being driven as fast as it could go. And we all set off. And it's hard to describe the experience because on the one hand, you're sitting there thinking, don't make a mess of this, don't make a mess of this. And, you know, you're trying to operate the car. It's not a difficult car to drive, but you still need to focus. And on the other hand, you're just getting swept away. I mean, because I was in basically the youngest car, they went with the old cars first. So they started with the 82s and they ended up with the 87 and the 88. So I was right at the back. And so I could see it all. I could see this snake of 956s and 962s. Oh, we all had our lights on. And as we're out there for 15, 20 minutes. And, you know, it was getting darker and darker and darker. And it was becoming more and more magical. And whoever was up the front always bunched the pack up, which I thought was a bit of a shame, actually, going into the first chicane. So we were sort of accelerating out of that and then going down the pit straight. And so a lot of us were hanging back to get a bit of space, which meant that by the time we sort of got through Magic around the back, we were properly getting on with it. And to be in a car that special, that important, to be turning it into Ford Water and into St. Mary's and all those wonderful places on that extraordinary circuit. I know those cars don't have any history at Goodwood, but that doesn't matter. it was, I mean, magical is the only word. You just sit there and you're thinking, I cannot believe I'm doing this. And you also, you know, the imposter syndrome becomes completely overwhelming because you just think, you know, I've got no history with these cars. You know, it's one thing, isn't it, to, you know, in a demo where you're not really meant to overtake, trundle around in these things at, you know, reasonably fast, but ultimately not close to what they can do. And then go to a place like Le Mans, pre-chicanes, and drive it for 24 hours with only one other driver, when there's no air conditioning, there's no power steering, through day, through night, through dry, through sun, through rain. And, you know, the more time you spend with these cars, the more you understand them. You know, I was pretty in awe of the people who drove these cars before I ever drove one myself. And the more I do, the more I just don't understand how they did it. The courage and the mental and the physical strength that they must have had to do that. There's no other word. Magical, was it? And then when it was all over and you came in, it was almost immediately like it hadn't happened. It was almost immediately like, and certainly when I finished this stupid other race that I did yesterday, trotting around the streets of Brighton, and I was sort of, so my wife came down and very kindly drove me home, and I was sitting in the passenger seat in so much pain, and I sort of tried to retreat to my happy place, and that was quite clearly behind the wheel of a 962C at Le Mans, Goodwood on Saturday evening. It didn't feel real at all then. It doesn't feel real now. But I've been sent enough photographs to know that it clearly was. And for me personally, the best thing about it were the Porsche guys. Because not once did anyone say to me, just remember what you're in, lad. Look after the machinery. I don't want to see anything more than, I don't know, 6,000 revs. Nobody said anything like that. They just go, there's the car. And, you know, okay, so it's completely a trust thing, and trust goes both ways. And if you cock it up, you'll never drive another. But so, and there's that balance, isn't there, between absolutely not taking any risks at all. But Porsche don't want their cars to be seen just trundling around the track going slowly. They want the cars to be demonstrated. They want the cars to be seen to be doing what they do. And so you know, driving slowly is not an option. Well, I just wouldn't do it anyway, but it's not an option. You have to get on with it. And, you know, if there was any skill, and, you know, I mean, and, you know, I wrote down some of the guys who were doing it out there. There were guys like, you know, Callum Lockie and Tiff and Marino and John Watson. And, you know, there were some proper, proper peddlers out there. And if any of us showed any skill at all, it was just, you know, it was just doing that. And, you know, all the cars went out, all the cars went round, all the cars came back. Nothing broke down. Nobody missed a gear. It was just, you know, it was a proper demonstration, and it was absolutely what it should have been. And it was, yeah, unbelievable.
So you said it's not a difficult car to drive, the 962. Talk me through it a little bit. No, no power steering. No. So weight in the steering?
Oh yeah, I mean, unbelievable weight in the steering. That's what makes me so in awe of the people who, you know, who did, you know, double, triple stints in these things. Terrible steering lock. I mean, to manoeuvre, just awful. But it's like so many racing cars, and you will have seen this stuff that you've driven. The closer they get to doing what it is they're designed to do, the easier they become. So the moment you can get a bit of heat in the tyres, the moment you can get a bit of downforce over the bodywork, this very unmanageable, awkward, it's almost like a sort of, I don't know, something like a seal on land, and then suddenly you chuck it in the water and it's off and it's beautiful and it's graceful and it's and that's what it's like. So there was somebody who'd not really driven that kind of car before in one of them, and because he knew that I'd driven those sorts of cars before, but was just saying, you know, what should I do? And I just said, you know, try and go fast, because the faster you go, the better it will feel. And actually, the safer you'll be. You'll be much less likely to. I mean, the closest I came in the 3 days I was with that car to making a kind of error was we were doing some filming actually on the Goodwood Hill, and I was pulling out of a car park, and I just turned left. And at, I don't know, walking pace, and the car just started understeering because the diffs are so tight on them, and I was on completely stone cold tyres. And, you know, it was so far removed from what it was ever designed to do. But, you know, as soon as you're up to speed, they are fine. So what's it like? So how fast is it? So they run that car at 660 horsepower. Quali boost in 87 for Le Mans would have been about 750. So it's, you know, it's at whatever that is. It's sort of 85% of maximum. But it weighs, actually, I think they changed, you're right, the rules for 82 were 800 kilos. I think before that car race, they bumped it up to 850. So I think it's an 850 kilo car. 660 horsepower, you do the maths. And just a bucket of torque. An absolute bucket of torque. And, you know, you come out the chicane and, you know, I'm lucky to have driven, you know, quite a lot of fast stuff. It is absolutely breathtaking the way this thing takes off. It just, I mean, you know, it's one of those things. And I've said this before about other cars, but I mean it about this, is, you know, it goes from the start of a straight to the end of a straight, seemingly by leaving the bit in the middle out of the way. You literally, you're thinking about accelerating and then there's kind of blur, a gear change, and then, oh, right, got to slow down now. It's that fast. The noise, which I never really enjoyed when I was watching them in period, because it's that rather sort of guttural, you know, fat six blare. I actually think it's quite charming now. And yeah, the faster you go, the heavier the steering gets, because, you know, you've obviously got the downforces starting to work on the car. But also, the faster you go, the more precise it becomes, for exactly that reason too. And it feels, you know, through the really quick stuff, particularly through Ford Water and going into St. Mary's, when you're going quite fast, it just feels so in its element. It's sitting there saying to you, okay, go, yeah, this is what we want to do. I remember what this is like. Let's carry on. And then you have to slow down because you caught up the course car again. So the gear shift is quite slow for a racing car. You've got to be quite precise with it. You've got to heel and toe it when you're changing down, because otherwise you could lock up the back axle. But other than that, you know, apart from the speed, it's a low wide car, and you have to forget its value and its importance and everything else, because that'll just completely mess with your mind. But beyond that, no, I wouldn't say it's a difficult car to drive. I mean, I would have been so much more stressed if we'd been doing a Group C Jaguar demonstration, because I'd be worried about damaging the gearbox, or, well, probably maybe not spinning it, but I'd have been more careful with it, definitely. But because it's a Porsche, because it was designed for gentlemen drivers, even, you know, idiots like me, it was, you know, they had that person in their mind. And it had to work for them as well as, you know, the Derricks and the Jackies of this world. And it does.
Bloody hell. What an experience.
Yeah. Lucky boy,
You're a lucky chap.
Lucky boy.
What a thing to do. And I guess you're gonna write about it, and we'll see some great pictures on the Explorer app soon.
Yeah, we'll see if we can pull a video together as well. I mean, there were a couple of onboard cameras, and I think we can get some of the external stuff from Goodwood. So we'll hopefully put together a bit of a film as well.
Fantastic. Good. Okay, well, we've got the listener question coming up, our new tradition to end each episode of the podcast. Thank you, though, to JBR Capital for coming on board as podcast sponsor. All their contact details are in the description. Please remember to rate and review the podcast wherever you listen to your podcast, whether it's Google, Apple, Spotify, anywhere else, or if you're watching on YouTube. Please do subscribe, follow. That really makes a difference. Let's do the listener question. It comes from Nicola Gianni. What makes a good manual gearbox and why? Given they are metal housings with cogs and levers inside, why, no matter the car, are some praised and become part of the experience? Here we go. A good geeky question for us to get into. I'll offer an answer to it first while you have a think, perhaps. And so what makes a good manual gearbox? Well, you need a good satisfying shift. And it's hard to describe exactly what that means, but you know when you feel one, the instant you feel one. I suppose it needs to suit the nature of the car to some degree, but it should be direct and quick and have a good weight to it, a very tightly defined gait. So you're not left wondering where the gears are. It should be nicely sprung. But the action is important. It needs to be matched to the clutch action. There are some cars where you find there's no resistance in the clutch pedal at all. And then you've got this weighty gear lever. And so what you want to feel is like depressing the clutch and moving the lever around is actually one movement. Like it's one component. And when the weights are all wrong, you don't get that impression at all. You want it to be, it should be easy to be smooth and slick with your shifts. Easy to rev match, or there should be an auto blip, which you can switch off if you want to do it yourself. So why do we get worked up about them? Well, it's particularly when you're driving on the road, and actually on track, I'd probably choose paddles, but on the road, it's just something else to do, something to keep you busy, something else to think about, something to do well, and so it's satisfying and rewarding. I could go on and on. I mean, the layout of the drivetrain is important. Getting a rear or mid-engine car to shift really sweetly, particularly a mid-engine car, actually, because the gearbox is such a long way away if it's on the rear axle. You know, the rods and cables have to navigate the engine bay. So it was very difficult to make those cars, to give those cars a really slick, satisfying shift. I remember driving a Porsche 914. So, you know, very early mid-engine Porsche, or relatively early, and finding the gear shift tricky and awkward and vague, just vague. Didn't really ever know where I was. Didn't know if I'd just got first or third. And much later Porsches, you know, even, say, a modern Boxster or Cayman, it's got such a sweet gear shift. And it's just a joy to use. And so it's very possible to do that well. And the last thing I will say about manual gear shifts is that I would rather have a really good paddle shift than a so-so manual. And the one that springs to mind, I've spoken about the Jaguar F-Type before, but I also drove an Alfa Giulia Quadrifoglio manual, which I don't think was ever offered in the UK, but we had a car from Europe, from Italy. And it had a horrible shift. Again, the weight of the shift was not matched to the clutch pedal. It was a bulky shift. It felt more like it'd come from a truck, that gearbox, rather than a sports car. And so it just got in the way of the driving experience. So in the case of that car, I'd far rather have the auto with the paddles. So that's me.
Wow.
Andrew, what makes a good gear shift?
Well, I'm not going to add all of that. So that's it.
Yeah.
I mean, ratios come into it. You want properly matched ratios, close if possible. You're absolutely right about a good paddle being worse than a poor manual. I think the other example was the last of the previous Aston Martin V12 Vantage S's. Do you remember they did those 7-speed manual cars at the end of that? Great, it was a manual V12 Vantage S, but it just wasn't a very nice manual. Not too many gears for me. I get, you know, Porsches, you know, 911s with 7 gears. I just get lost. I just, you know, my brain is too small. You know, 5's fine, 6 is great, 7's too many. The feel of the gear lever, the actual gear knob, the thing you hang on to, really important to me. It's got to be the right shape. It's got to have the right, either make it completely hold or just give it have a little bit of gear. You don't want to see these sort of squishy things. It could be a nice thing to hang on to. I also like visually an exposed gate. I mean, Ferrari, obviously, the great exponents of this. And I like the noise as well of it scraping and, scratching its way around the gate. And I think between us, I think that's a pretty comprehensive answer, isn't it?
Yeah, I think that's pretty good.
Yeah, you'll know it when you feel it.
Well, thank you for that. Yeah, that's it. You know it when you feel it. So thank you for that question. Keep your questions coming in. We're going to finish every episode of the podcast by answering your questions. So get them across to us any way you like, email, through social media. You can, send us a letter if you like, if you manage to find our address. But if you come up with a good, interesting question, we will answer it. So thank you all for listening. We'll be back next week.
Look forward to it. Thanks all.
Mom
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win. And support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. The future isn't scary, not realizing its potential, however, could be. Just like on the recruiting trail, I've seen potential come in many forms as a coach. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.